Thank you very much. I just wanted to correct one thing. The first time animal rights was taught was when I was teaching at Penn. By the time we got to Rutgers, it was becoming a more popular sort of thing. But I taught it in 1984, animal rights theory at the University of Pennsylvania, which I believe was the first time it was taught in an American law school. The title of the talk is Animal Rights versus Animal Welfare, Making the Case, which actually was Ted's title. He sent me an email and he said, I'm going to give it this title unless you tell me not to. And my alternative...
Well, actually, it's a terrible title.
Fine. Well, Ted purported it to be his title.
Come and clean up.
Yes. Now, he was guilty. Ted is not sharing with us the fact that he... And my alternative title was Animal Welfare, Scourge of the Earth. And I thought, his was... and go with Ted. Can you all hear me in the back? Is that okay? Is that right? Okay. All right. What I want to talk about tonight is basically the position that we hear a great deal, that there's no difference between the animal welfare and the animal rights position, that we need to pursue welfarist regulation, i.e. to make animal exploitation more humane in order to help animals now, that welfare regulation will lead to abolition in the long run, that we need to pursue regulation because that's going to lead to abolition in the long run. Part of this position is that the animal rights or the abolitionist position is utopian or ideal, and that it doesn't really provide anything practical to do, and that it's just too idealistic and too non-practical, and that we should, that even if we aren't sort of inclined with the abolitionist or animal rights perspective, we ought to follow this two-track approach, that we ought to pursue veganism, but we also ought to pursue animal rights or animal welfare regulation. That's the position that I want to talk about. And that position, I admit, has a lot of intuitive plausibility. We got to do something to help now. We don't feel frustrated. The feelings of animals are suffering. The answer, what I'm talking about tonight is why I think those positions, the various parts of what I just described as the position I want to talk about, are wrong. Let me start off with saying there is a huge difference between animal welfare and human and animal rights. A huge difference. Okay? Let's think about two concepts. The concept of use and the concept of treatment. These are different concepts. Whether we use animals for a particular purpose is a different question from how we treat them pursuant to that purpose. Whether, for example, we use animals for food is a different question from whether we keep them in intensive situations, or whether we keep them in free-range situations, or whatever. They're different questions. Do you understand? Okay. And by the way, if there's anything, I'm going to talk, and then I'm going to have a session. We'll have time for questions, answers, criticisms, slurs, whatever it is that you want, we'll do it. But what I do want you, if there's something that's not clear, just pop your hand up, because I don't want anything to be unclear. As a matter of fact, let me say this. I had a PowerPoint presentation done for tonight. And last night I looked at it, and I thought I didn't like it, precisely because I was afraid it wouldn't really be everyone's cup of tea. It was really heavy duty into a lot of philosophy, and I thought, no, I didn't want to do that. So I redesigned it. Unfortunately, I didn't do a PowerPoint presentation. There is something I'm going to show you, a video I'm going to show you, which is why I had put them to the trouble of setting up the equipment anyway. I'm not going to be doing the PowerPoint presentation. I do want you to understand the point that I'm making. So if something is not clear, then just let me know, and I will be more than happy to clarify. Okay? So the distinction between use and treatment, this is very, very important to understand. Whether we use animals is a different question from how we use them. Okay? Whether we use them for purpose X is different from how we treat them pursuant to the use for purpose X. The animal welfare position focuses on treatment. basically. Focuses on treatment and doesn't really look at use. In other words, the animal welfare position is that use per se, the use of animals per se, doesn't raise the primary, or for some welfare, even a moral question. The issue is how we treat animals. It is all right to use animals for human purposes, as long as we treat them a particular way. As long as we accord whatever level of protection the particular person, the particular welfare is advocated, as long as we give that level of protection, then our use of animals is morally acceptable. Okay? As opposed to the animal rights position, which is, it doesn't really matter how well we treat them. Okay? We have no moral justification for using them in any under any circumstance. Those are very, very different positions. Now, I want to discuss a little bit about the history of the animal welfare position so you can see how we got to where it is today. Before the 19th century, basically animals were regarded as things. They were excluded completely from the moral and legal community. They were regarded as not having any moral value whatsoever. We were thought not to have any moral obligations that we could owe directly to animals. Now, that doctrine took two forms, two or three, depending on how you count, but let's just say two forms. I'll describe them. You can figure out whether they're two or three, but that's really sort of a sub-issue. The first way of thinking about animals and things is exemplified by a guy like René Descartes, okay, who was a late 16th century, early 17th century thinker, who basically maintained that animals had no minds whatsoever. And he had all sorts of reasons for this. But he basically did not think that animals had any interests whatsoever. And that there was nothing they preferred, desired, or wanted. When I use the expression to have interest, when I say an animal has an interest, what I mean is that the animal prefers or desires or wants something. And, you know, I think we all understand what that means. We all prefer, desire, or want something, or want to do. This is what we call an interest. Right? Descartes didn't think animals had interests. He thought they were automatons. He thought that they were machines. He actually called them automatons. Actually, he got the idea from walking around royal gardens in France at that time. He could see these hydraulic figures, and they were quite elaborate. And when you walked near these hydraulic figures, the pressure from your feet would cause the water to go into these hydraulic devices, which were large statues, and they would move, and they would seem to be alive. That's what Descartes thought. Descartes thought, just as humans built these machines that appear to be alive, you know, and made machines that move and, you know, appear to be animated, God created animals. They appear to be animated. They appear to be alive. They're alive. But they appear to be moving of their own volition. But really what they are, they're automatons. They don't have volition. They don't have interest. They don't have ideas. They don't have rationality. They don't have any thought. They have no mind. These are creatures without minds. In other words, there is no difference between a clock and a dog. As a matter of fact, Descartes used to, at the time there was no anesthesia. Anesthesia had not been invented yet. So Descartes would cut open animals that were nailed to boards. And when the animals screamed and people said, "Hey, René, don't you think that animal's experiencing pain?" René would say, "No." He would say, "This is the noise that this animal is making is really no different from the whining of a gear or whatever in a machine that needs to be oiled." Okay? Hey, look, you know, you might think it's crazy. This guy's considered to be like one of the great minds of Western. Well, you know, he was whatever. And you can draw your own conclusions about him. But in any event, so if Descartes were right, if in fact animals are automatons, if they're machines, then we really couldn't have moral obligations to them any more than we could have moral obligations to clocks. I can have a moral obligation that concerns a clock, like I have an obligation perhaps not to smash the clock if the clock is your clock. Or I have an obligation not to take that machine over there and throw it at you, but that's an obligation I owe to you. It's an obligation that concerns the machine, but it's an obligation I owe to you. So Descartes would accept that there may be obligations that I have that concern animals. For example, I may have an obligation, both legal and moral, not to injure your cow because that cow is your property. But Descartes did not believe that we could have obligations that we owe directly to animals because they weren't the sorts of creatures to whom one could have moral obligations any more than that is the sort of device to which one can have a moral obligation. Right, so that's the first sort of way of thinking about animals as things, as exemplified by Descartes. Now Descartes was a pretty wild and crazy guy, and he was unusual in Western thinking in that most people really didn't think that animals were not sentient, for example. They weren't perceptually aware and able to feel pain. Most people, like Aristotle and Aquinas and Kant and Locke, and basically most of the other thinkers of Western civilization, again, I want to limit, when I'm talking about these ideas, I understand there's a huge difference. When you start talking about Eastern civilization, you're then getting into a very, very different sort of way of thinking about non-human animals, particularly because of the way the concept of ahimsa or non-violence has played in various religions like Hinduism and Jainism and Buddhism. And so it's a very, very different. So I'm talking about Western civilization, which is basically what influences us most and what is really the background noise of our lives in terms of how we think about non-humans, all right, at least for most of us. All right, so the other category of people, Descartes sort of in a class by himself. Then you got everybody else. And everybody else, Kant, Locke, they recognize that animals had interests. They recognize that animals could feel pain. They realized that animals were perceptually aware. They realized animals had interests. There were things they preferred or desired or wanted. But that it was all right for us to treat animals as if they were things, as if they were automatons, as if they didn't matter, because they were inferior to us. And they were inferior to us in two ways. And these overlapped. They were either inferior because they were spiritually inferior. They were made, we're made in God's image, particularly those of us who are born male. And animals are not born, and are not created in God's image. Okay? They don't have souls. They don't have, they're spiritual, there are spiritual inferiors. That's an idea that you see in a lot of thinkers. Okay? The other sort of inferiority was cognitive or mental inferiority. That is, people like Kant, for example, Immanuel Kant, German philosopher. Kant recognized that animals were sentient, that they were perceptually aware, that they felt pain, that they had interest. He understood that. He understood that one could harm them. Whereas for Descartes, you can't really harm an animal any more than I can harm that machine. I can wreck the machine. I can't harm the machine. Okay? But Kant recognized we could harm animals. But he thought that it was all right for us to exclude them from the moral community because they were not rational. They were not self-aware. They didn't have mind letters. They weren't capable of engaging in moral reciprocity. We have moral obligations to each other. We can reciprocate. We can engage in, we can have a reciprocal moral relationship. Animals can't do that, Kant thought. Animals aren't rational, Kant thought. And this is quite common. This permeates most of Western thinking about non-human animals. Okay? It also permeates Western thinking about slaves. It permeates Western sort of thinking about women at various times. But its most extreme form was in talking about non-humans. Okay? And so, people like Kant, people like Locke, for example, he thought animals were rational, but he didn't think that they were capable of understanding abstract concepts. Okay? They didn't have concepts like a class of that, we know that there's a bunch of things called chairs. They all look different, but we understand. We have the concept of a chair, and we know that it can be a big, bad thing, or it can be one of these sorts of things, and it can be a big, plush chair, and it can be, whatever, all sorts of chairs. But we have the concept of a chair. He did not believe that animals had abstract concepts. Therefore, we could treat them as if they were automatons or machines, or we could exclude them completely from the moral community. Okay? This is also reflected in the law. Basically, before the 19th century, you don't have legislation that really, you have legislation that protects people's property. So, you know, if you had malice towards me and you injured my cow, you might be prosecuted for malicious mischief. But that was because you had malice towards me and you wrecked some of my property. It really didn't matter whether you damaged my cow or my tractor. It didn't really matter. Okay, what mattered was you had malice to me. Basically, there wasn't legislation before the 19th century that recognized that animals had some sort of legal personality, were partial, at least partial members of the moral and legal community, and they could be for beings to whom we had direct moral and legal obligations. This changed in the 19th century. First in England, largely as a result of progressive social movements where people started to say, gee, you know, slavery's not really a good idea, and you know, there's a problem with women not being able to vote, and you know, and so when progressive social movements, okay, start arising in the 19th, beginning of the 19th, end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, you have people like Jeremy Bentham, okay, who said, who was a lawyer and a philosopher, and you know, he said, well, gee, you know, what difference does it make if they can think rationally, or if they can use symbolic communication, you know, with language? What difference does it make? What matters is they can suffer, and if they can suffer, they matter more. That sentience is all that's necessary to be a member of the moral community, and for us to have direct obligations that we owe to that other, to the other, basically. Problem is, it sounds really revolutionary. It was in certain ways, but it wasn't in other ways. And that Bentham thought that animals were sentient, so therefore they mattered more. But he thought because they weren't rational, or because, and particularly, he didn't think they were self-aware. He didn't think they had an interest in their lives. He didn't really think that they thought about themselves as selves. So basically what Bentham said, and I actually do have, you know, for those of you who sort of really want to be, I would say pedantic or progressive secular, I do actually have quotes on cards that I was going to sort of make you all read that I decided to, you know, I want to put people to sleep about me. You know, here's a quote from Jeremy Bentham. Let them all read it. But I do actually have the quote. And so if you're that sort of person and you want to incur the reaction of others in the group who will scorn you and hate you, or we do the question and answer session, I'll be happy to put a quote on the thing and you can read it. But in any event, so what Bentham said was, hey look, they can suffer, and that's all that's necessary. It doesn't matter whether they can think rationally, whether they can do mathematics, whether they can use language, whether they can use symbolic language. That don't matter. What matters is they can suffer. However, because they don't have minds like ours, because their minds aren't like ours, they don't really have an interest in their lives. They don't care that we use them. They only care how we use them. So he goes into this, you know, he talks about how, you know, eating them, that's okay. You know, and if you ever saw pictures of Jeremy Bentham, you know, he didn't get stomach from eating vegetables. So Bentham says, you know, it's all right for us to eat them. That's fine. Because they don't care. They don't care if we eat them. They just care about how we treat them. We have an obligation to treat them well. Okay? And thus is born the animal welfare movement with this fundamental, foundational premise. It's a foundational premise that animals don't have an interest in continued existence. They don't have an interest in their lives. Okay? This is an idea that sort of permeates, I mean, basically, the folks who are thought to be sort of the founders of the animal welfare movement, John Stuart Mill saw thought similarly to Bentham, as did most people then. And what's interesting now is the person I would identify as sort of the leading spokesperson for the animal welfare movement now is Peter Singer. And it is a fundamental part of Peter Singer's view. The animals don't have an interest in continued existence. He thinks that the non-human great apes do. He thinks some other animals might, like dolphins. But he thinks basically, also like Singer quotes, but if he knows, we can talk about those. And basically what Peter says is that animals don't have an interest in their lives. is very important about how we treat them. But he draws a distinction between the killing issue and the suffering issue. Okay? Which is why he talks about and says things like, well, you know, veganism is a good thing generally to reduce suffering, but, you know, the luxury of, you know, if you want to eat meat now and then, that's fine, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, and you know, people who, you know, like to be vegans, but they like to go out to expensive restaurants and have, you know, disgustingly, horribly tortured corpses, that's okay, and, you know, that sort of thing, because he draws this distinction between killing and suffering, and he sees veganism only as a means to reduce suffering, which is really something that permeates, again, a lot of quarters of the movement now. So I'm going to get to that in a little while. Okay, let me look at my big note. It says, I have quotes if you want them. Okay, now, the animal rights view rejects this position, okay? First of all, it rejects the notion that czars use animals, okay? But it rejects the notion... Rejects the view that animals are abuse animals. It rejects basically the foundational premise of the animal welfare movement that animals don't have an interest in continued existence. At least as I have developed that view. I mean, you know, Reagan's view and mine differ in certain ways. But basically, the position I take is that if you're sentient, okay, you're self-aware. The notion that Bentham said that, well, you know, you can be sentient but not self-aware, not have a sense of yourself. That's a very bizarre notion. To me, that's a very bizarre notion. And you know, one of the things I find very interesting is a biologist at Harvard. His name is Don Griffin. He's dead. He died not too far in the past. And Don Griffin took the position. And Don Griffin was not an animal rights guy. He was just a biologist. And he wrote a book called Animal. I think the book's called Animal Minds. And he was a biologist who was interested in cognitive pathology. And one of the things that Don said was, he said, look, he said if an animal's perceptually aware, and the animal's like out there and is watching other animals running up the tree, the animal realizes, on some level, the animal realizes that, hey, it ain't me that's running up the tree, somebody else is running up the tree. So if I'm perceptually aware, Don argues, I have to be, on some level, self-aware. You see? And I think that really the problem with Bentham's view, Singer's view, that animals aren't self-aware, that it's really tied to this notion that in order to be self-aware, you have to be somebody who looks in the mirror and says, hey, that's me. That's one way of recognizing yourself. But it's not the only way of recognizing yourself. Or, you know, Singer talks a lot about the ability to think in the past and anticipate the future. That, you know, in order to have a sense of yourself, you have to have a sense of the past and a sense of the future. And the answer is, yeah, that's one way of having a sense of yourself. It's not the only way of having a sense of yourself. How many people in this room saw the movie Momentum? Okay, well, then you're aware of the phenomenon of transient global amnesia, which is, you know, the guy in Momentum was sort of stuck in this perpetual present, which is the way Bentham viewed and the way Singer views the mind of most animals. Singer viewed all, or Bentham viewed all animal minds that way. Singer views animal minds that way that aren't great, not even great aged dolphin, and perhaps some other species. But basically, the welfare see the animal mind as rooted in a continual present. Because the guy in Memento, you remember, for those of you who didn't see the movie, it's actually an interesting movie, and from this perspective, it's an interesting movie to see. Because it involves a guy who's got transient global amnesia, which is a phenomenon, it's an actual neurological phenomenon, where you don't have a sense of the past and you don't have a sense of the future. You have a sense of yourself right now, right here. And it doesn't go anywhere else. You have a sense of yourself. It just doesn't go into the future. It doesn't go into the past. Now, would we say it's all right to use such a person in biomedical experiments to help people who didn't have transient global amnesia? Is it all right to take the organs out of somebody who has transient global amnesia in order to save the lives of people who don't have transient global amnesia? Now, most people, as a matter of fact, most people I meet, virtually all of them, would say, no, that would really be horrible. A person who's got global amnesia, transient global amnesia, may have a different sense of self than the sense of self I've got, you've got, most other people have, but there's still a sense of self there. Furthermore, the notion that sentient beings, that something can be perceptually aware, able to feel pain, and not have an interest in continued existence strikes me as nonsense. I mean, think about it for a second. Why do beings, what beings are sentient? Well, we don't know, we may not know the answer about insects and stuff like that, because that's a question of judgment. What about insects? What about insects question? And I don't know about insects. You know, I don't kill them. When they're in my house and they're large, too large to, I don't feel coexistence as small as they are, I will catch them and put them outside. I will never forget my first job out of law school. I was in graduate school in philosophy and law school at the same time. My first job out was I was a clerk for a federal judge in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I went to the University of Virginia, and I knew bugs. I didn't know what a palmetto bug was, which is a nice term for a big copper. And I never saw one of these things until I was down. Right. There was a question in my mind as to whether or not it would be inconsistent with my animal rights to ride them to work. They were big. And I will never forget, when we first moved down to the world, we were living in the French Quarter, and we went into our apartment, which we had rented without seeing it, and we went in, and the landlord had set a roach bomb, and there were these bugs. And I was like, I walked in, and I saw these things, and I said, what are they? Anna Charlton, who is my colleague and my partner, was from Britain. They don't have things like that in Britain because, you know, the rain kills us. We were both a little concerned about it, so we called the organ guy. And the organ guy comes over, and he had a briefcase, and he opens the briefcase, and it's got plexiglass lock, and it's got like all the different sorts of cockroaches, and he showed us the one that we had, and we listened to him for a while, and I said, look, I said, my only question is, how do we do this so we don't kill them? And he looked at me and said, you don't want to kill them? I said, no, I said, there must be a way to not kill them. And he just very quietly, very gently, put the blocks back. And he said, there's nothing I can do for you. And we walked out of our house. And what we learned later on was that they don't like light. And so we had all of our food, everything, from like breakfast, dry breakfast seals, in the refrigerator for an entire year, because they're all in the fridge bed. And we didn't have any food in the cupboards. And we kept the lights on. I mean, environmentally, it was not cool, I agree. But, so we kept the lights on, and we coexisted, they stay, and they fly. I have to tell you, it's when we first saw one, and we had a very high ceiling in the living room, I thought it was a bird. I mean, I don't kill things that crawl. But the one thing that we do know is, with respect to all the animals that we explore, all the chickens, all the cows, all the pigs, all the fish, mollusks, maybe an open farm, I don't eat them either. But with respect to all the animals we routinely exploit, okay, those animals are sentient. They're able to feel pain. Those animals have evolved sentience in order to survive. Sentience is not something which develops for the hell of it. It is a characteristic which develops in beings that move and can use sensation to get away from things which are dangerous to their lives. So the notion is that for me, for somebody to say X is sentient, but X does not have an interest in continued existence, strikes me as nonsense. I mean, this is one of the reasons I always get, I recently came back from a wonderful time at a major university in which I was speaking just with faculty. It was a faculty retreat, and I was the guest person who was the outside, the faculty person who was coming to talk about animal issues. And so we spent a lot of time, these are people who are not animal people, and they're people who haven't really thought about these issues before, so we ended up spending a lot of time talking about whether plants are sentient. Which is something, if y'all want to talk about that, we can talk about that. If you want. And I was sort of puzzled by that. Why do people think that plants are sentient? I mean, why would, just as a matter of like sort of common sense and what we know about, we're not in Kansas, so we all basically accept the evolutionary theory, I think. So why would plants evolve the characteristic of being sentient? Like they can't do anything about it except stand there. And you take a cigarette lighter and put it to the dog, and it's just like every one of us does. Take a cigarette lighter and put it to the plant, that thing gets through. But the idea that animals are sentient, but don't have an interest in continuing existence, strikes me as just being totally crazy. So the animal rights position, first of all, rejects the notion that animals don't have an interest in continued existence because they're not self-aware. It takes the position that they're self-aware, and I'm perfectly happy to acknowledge that because we use language, because my context, your context, because our head, everything that goes on in our heads is very, very much tied to the fact that we use language, symbolic communication. Our concepts are very, very intimately tied to our language. I don't know what it would be like to be, none of us here knows that. What it would be like to be conscious and have concepts that aren't linked to our linguistic characteristics that we have. But that doesn't mean that animals don't think or have very, very complicated ways of thinking. As a matter of fact, if you've ever lived with a dog or a cat, and you wonder what they can think, I find that peculiar. I mean, I never had a dog. Until I was an adult, I grew up in a house where, my brother had allergies, and I had allergies and stuff, and we didn't have, I had, like, frogs and snakes and stuff when I was a child. But there's a limit on how you can, you call it snakes, and although I'm sure those animals have very complicated cognitions, snake cognitions and frog cognitions or whatever, now that I have dogs, and I've been living with dogs since I was 28, it's really quite remarkable how anybody could wonder about whether they think. But are there concepts? I have no doubt that their concepts are different from mine, but there's also no doubt in my mind that they have some sort of equivalent concepts of certainly rationality, of abstract concepts. I have a border collie. Border collies I have a rescue border collie, one of the dogs that we have. And she is one of the most remarkable animals I've ever met. She's got an incredible, she understands quite a bit. She's smarter than most of the human animals. I mean, she's very, very smart, very smart. She clearly doesn't have concepts that are the same as mine. I don't know what her concepts are like because her concepts are not based in language, but there's no doubt in my mind she has equivalents. Okay, now the animal rights position rests very heavily on the principle of equal consideration. You have to treat similar cases similarly. Now we accord every human, at least we in theory, accord every human being the right not to be property. Slavery still does exist. Slavery still does exist. But you know what? Nobody defends it. You never hear people saying, we discovered slavery here, I think it's a good idea. I mean, who knows? There are people, Republicans, who may think that. Most people think, you're Republican. I haven't really been exposed to one. No.
I'm in defense.
Okay. Nobody thinks that slavery is a good thing. And we regard every sentient human And, you know, we might have a debate about what do you do with somebody who's irreversibly brain dead. You know, I mean, something like that. You know, I mean, we could have an interesting philosophical question. We could also have an interesting question about early term. I mean, we could talk about abortion. We could talk about abortion. But anyway, frankly, I don't think there's any evidence to indicate that first trimester fetuses, which is where most abortions are had during the first trimester, there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that they're sentient. So if you've got beings which aren't sentient, and they have souls, I don't want to offend anybody who believes they have souls. So, I want to make it clear. We regard every sentient human, irrespective of whether they're intelligent, whether they're stupid, whether they're, you know, geniuses or severely mentally challenged, or whether they're really beautiful or not, or whatever their personal characteristics are, we regard every human as having a pre-legal, it's illegal, it's protected by the law, but it's really sort of a pre-legal, it's the right you've got to have in order to have any legal rights. You can't be somebody else's property. That's what's particularly insidious about slavery. All forms of exploitation are bad, but slavery is particularly bad. Because slavery treats someone as an economic commodity and empowers somebody else to value all of that person's interests, including that person's interest in continued existence and being and having suffering and whatever inflicted on him or her. All of the fundamental interests are valued by somebody else, i.e. the owner. Okay? And most of us think that's not good. That's not good. That's not a good situation. And we regard every human as having a right not to be the property of somebody else. So now the question becomes, is there any reason, any logical, morally sound reason, other than speciesism, which is not logical, nor morally sound, and it's no different from racism, sexism, heterosexism, ageism, and any of the other irrelevant criteria that we use and have historically used to exclude people from the moral and legal community, is there any reason to say that animals should have the right not to be treated as property? And the answer is no, there is not. I mean, whatever defect it is that we believe they have that entitles us to treat that as commodity is a defect that some of us have, and yet we would never think of it as appropriate to use those people who have that particular quote defect end quote as for organ donors and people by medical experiments or ex-slaves. So if we accord this one right to animals, the right not to be property, what it basically means is we have to get rid of all institutionalized exploitation. It means no more domestication. It means we don't, you know, we take care of the animals that we've got now, but we don't bring more domestic animals into existence. People always say, aha, but you have dogs. Yes, I have dogs. They are rescued animals. They are refugees. They live with you. They would all be dead if they didn't live with us. You will never find anybody on planet Earth who enjoys hanging out with dogs more than I do. And if there were two left on the planet and it were up to me, whether they were going to breed so that we could continue to have pets, the answer would be no way. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, I mean, we should not have domestic animals. The only animals, I mean, when you think about it, animal ethics deals with how we deal with conflicts between human animals and non-human animals. We manufacture the conflicts. The conflicts are false conflicts. We bring these animals into existence. We drag them. One of the books I wrote is, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child to the Dog. And in the front of the book, it's a burning house with a kid in one window and a dog in the other. You know, and what I try to argue in the book, is that we drag these animals into the burning house. And then we say, oh God, what are our moral obligations? But we've created them. We drag them. We create domestic animals. We facilitate the creation of domestic animals. We drag them into the burning house. And then we say, what are our moral obligations? The answer I suggest to you is foreordained. They lose, we win. That's the way it always is. It's what it was with slavery, by the way. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. Now, one thing I want to say before I go on to the next point. I'm trying to move it straight, right? One thing is that welfareism relies on the notion that less suffering is better than more suffering. Well, you know what? Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's sort of hard to argue with, right? I mean, obviously, it is better to inflict less suffering than it is to inflict more suffering. However, that doesn't mean that it is a good idea to maintain that inflicting less suffering is a morally desirable thing that we ought to be working, that we ought to be praising. You know, it really bothers me very, very much when I see things like the Certified Raising Humane label, which is sponsored by, I forget the primary organization, but it's supported by HSUS, or the Animal Compassion Standard of Whole Foods, which is supported by PETA, Animal Rights International, Farm Sanctuary, Vegan Outreach, and virtually all the other large organizations. Or Freedom Foods, which is supported by the RSPCA, and really bothers me that we're telling people, hey, buy these corpses and these animal products which have been tortured less. This is a morally desirable thing. This is what we, and again, I actually have photographs of some of the website on my PowerPoint presentation, which are being deprived of at this very moment. And which people are encouraged to buy this stuff. This is how you show you care. Go to the store and buy Freedom Foods. This is how you show you care. Go and buy your corpses from Whole Foods. This is how you show you care. Get a HSUS humane raised and handled labeled corpse or animal product, and that's a good thing to do. Think about it for a second. If I murder you, is it worse if I torture you? Yes. As a matter of fact, I teach in addition to animal rights. Records is not payment. You just teach animal rights and stuff. I wish they didn't know. I teach criminal law, I teach criminal procedure, I teach evidence. And when I teach criminal law, if you kill somebody in a lot of states, if you torture them in addition to killing them, you can become eligible for the death penalty. I was thinking it was weird, eligible for the death penalty. So you want something. Hey, I'm eligible for the death penalty. But if you become eligible for the death penalty, if you torture somebody in addition to murder them, but if you murder somebody without torturing them, we don't give you an award. We don't do what PETA did, with slaughterhouse designer Temple Grandin, give her an award. We don't do what PETA did and give Whole Foods an award for being, the best retailer, the best animal-friendly retailer. I mean, assuming that these welfare regulations actually reduce suffering, and I'm going to go on in a minute, second, I'm not sure that they do, but assuming that were the case, it still is bizarre. It's bizarre that we're telling people, hey, you didn't torture somebody, you tortured somebody less than, you murdered somebody, and, you could have used that cigarette lighter for a half an hour, and you only did it for 25 minutes. You get an award. We're going to give you an award. And there's something very bizarre about it. So, yeah, it's obviously better to inflict less suffering rather than more. But that doesn't mean that inflicting that less harm is a morally desirable thing to do in the sense that we want to normatively praise it or encourage it or promote it as the goal of a social movement. I think it's bizarre. And then you know, okay. All right. Now, point two. That was just point one. The other point. Point two is a very practical concern. Animal welfare regulation does not work. Okay. So, in a sense, it's really interesting to sort of say, well, if animal welfare worked, it would really be interesting to sort of try to discuss whether or not it was morally the right thing to do. But you know what? It don't work. And it doesn't work for the following reason. Animals are property. They are economic commodities. They don't have any extra, they don't have any intrinsic inherent value. They only have extrinsic or conditional value. They have economic value. Okay? They have only the value that we accord them. Now, if you look at the history of animal welfare, basically, most animal welfare measures, and I'm going to talk about a couple of them, this analysis or this framework I'm going to give you is true of virtually all animal welfare measures. What animal welfare does is it makes animal exploitation more economically efficient for producers, and it makes meat cheaper for consumers, or animal products cheaper for consumers. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Because, see, the theory of the animal welfare is, well, if we regulate it, it's going to make it more expensive. And if we make it more expensive, then the demand will drop because output will drop. And then only people with money So this is sort of, it's not only is it wrong, but it's elitist. It's basically, well, you know, let everybody else, you know, eat styrofoam or whatever. And but, you know, rich people, they can, you know, people with money can still afford to buy animal products. I mean, it's a very, very troubling theory in a number of different ways. But the basic position of animal welfare is by regulating, you increase production costs. You decrease output, you decrease demand. So you're basically shifting the demand curve over. Don't work that way. Case in point, your Humane Slaughter Act of 1958. And this, by the way, is like the area in which I'm doing most of my research now. I'm working with an economist who's an econometrician. She's a microeconomics person and an econometrician. And we're working, what we're doing is we're examining various instances of animal welfare, both in the United States and in Europe. And what we're finding is basically the animal welfare regulations fit this pattern pretty clearly. That what animal welfare regulation does is it actually makes animal exploitation more efficient. Animal industries are very inefficient. So they do not operate in accordance, I mean, whether any industry operates in accordance with the economic model of efficiency is a big question. But certainly, animal exploitation industries don't. And there are all sorts of reasons for that historically, why they don't. And we'll get into that later on if you're interested. But it's not an efficient industry. And what animal welfare regulation does is it makes it more efficient. Case in point, the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958. Look at the legislative history of the Humane Slaughter Act, because it's really quite instructive. Basically, it was something that when you slaughter an animal, big animal, cow, sheep, something like that, pig, you're talking about, and you wrap a chain, unless you're dealing with kashrut or halal, basically, you know, there's certain sorts of, I mean, you're basically tying a chain for both, putting a chain around the animal's leg, and hoisting the animal up, okay? Now, that animal is moving around a lot. A 2,000-pound animal, in case of a cow, for example, moves around a lot, hits people, injures workers, carcass damage occurs. Okay? If you look at the history of the Humane Slaughter Act, which is very, very minimal, all it does is require that before the animal shackled or hoisted and you cut into the animal has to be stunned, unless it's kashrut or halal. And that the animal has to be stunned. It really provides very, very, I mean, there's all sorts of parts of the animal's life that are not touched by the Humane Slaughter Act, including a lot that goes on at the slaughterhouse. It's at the very moment of death, because we don't want the animal moving around a lot, because there were all sorts of worker injuries, and there was carcass damage. And so if you look at the legislative history, you see Congress was quite explicit in saying, we believe this is good legislation because it will cut down on worker injuries, it will produce higher quality meat. It's economically justified. And if you look at the campaigns we're dealing with right now, whether it's the gestation crate campaign, which is going on here, or the controlled atmosphere killing campaign, you know, and again, I've got a blog, I didn't have time to, I have a blog essay coming out on this. I get home tomorrow night, so probably Tuesday sometime, I hope, in which I talk about this. But if you look at the most recent campaigns, the gestation crate campaign, controlled atmosphere killing campaign, you see HSUS and PETA basically promoting these things. They will cut down on production costs. That if you, for example, that the sow productivity, that's not my expression, that's HSUS's expression, that sow productivity is higher if you don't use a gestation crate. Studies show this, and that's true. If you take the animal out of the gestation crate and use what they call electronic sow feeding, which allows you to have animals in a, you know, this, you don't give them a lot of space, you give them more space, but, you know, not a lot of space. It actually cuts down on veterinary costs. It causes their reproductive cycles to function more efficiently from the producer's point of view, and it makes the animals more productive, and it cuts down on the production costs. For controlled atmosphere killing, even though the Humane Slaughter Act does not apply, and did not apply in 1958 to chickens, because people thought, what the hell, chickens, I mean, they move around, they're not going to really kill anybody, are they? I mean, they're not like a cow moving around a lot, chicken moving around a lot, bumping into somebody, ain't going to cause worker injuries. But one of the things we now know as a result of studies done by the meat industry is that the way we're killing poultry now results in a lot of carcass damage. That's economically uncool. That's not good for the producers, and it's not good for those of us who eat chicken. Okay? Because the more bodies they have to throw away, the higher the cost. It's not efficient. So one of the arguments, which is made explicitly, and I provide also, I've written other essays about this in which you can find these links, but the one I'm going to be doing on Tuesday deals specifically with this. You can actually find the links. I give you the links with H. Frazier, C.S. and Peter. You can read their literature, and you can see what they're saying, and what they're saying is, look at the studies. They're citing the studies done by the meat industry, done by poultry scientists, done by sow productivity scientists, you know, basically agricultural economists. And what they're telling us is those studies show that by providing some added protection to animal interests, you're actually putting more money in the pocket of producers. Ted Barnett, you have a question, sir.
I have a couple of the logic here. Why would something that helps the industry require legislation?
Ted, that's a good question, and if I planted that one, it couldn't have been any better. Because the industry is inefficient, Ted. The industry is inefficient, and
why would it be inefficient?
Well, the reason for that is because factory farming, intensive farming, developed about 50 years ago. On the theory that if you got 10 animals and you got them in a space and you're making $1, you know, and you add 10 more animals, you know, you're going to make $2. And, you know, and basically it was we'll get a greater economy of scale. The more animals we shove into this building, the more money we're going to make. Okay? And nobody ever thought about, these are sentient beings. These are beings who are going to respond to the stress that we impose on them in ways that will economically screw us. So what's happening now is the industry, and this is, I mean, I don't know enough economics to know, although my economist colleague tells me that this is not uncommon with other industries, that basically this industry developed fairly rapidly, and it didn't really, information wasn't perfect, there wasn't perfect information, so there couldn't be a purely rational response. So now, it is only now that information is starting to come out, which suggests that these practices, which have been used by animal agriculture people, are not economically efficient. Okay? So, you know, it's very clear, I mean, it really is very clear, you can see this. And you know, you can look at this with respect to animal experimentation. You can see that, and I will tell you, let me tell you, I first started thinking about this when I was teaching at Penn. I went to a meeting of vivisectors at the medical school, that was held at the medical school. And this was at the time they were thinking about the 1985 amendments to the Animal Welfare Act, which were going to require an animal care committee and certain sorts of animal, maybe these were husbandry, improvements. And I remember going to that meeting, and a lot of the vivisectors were really very unhappy about it. This one guy got up and he spoke, and he said, you know, I don't know why you all are upset about this. He said, because think about it. He said, all it says is, we can't expose the animals to stress. You know, if it's not a dehydration or a starvation experiment, which we can do those, doesn't stop us, but if it's not a dehydration or a starvation experiment, and we don't give them food and water, what that's going to do is it's going to introduce stress. That's going to result in scientific data that is compromised. So we're going to be adding a variable that is not a good variable to add, and a variable that we're not controlling for. And this is going to result in bad science. All this is doing is saying that we've got to use these animals in a way so that we get good data out of them. And I was sitting there thinking, wow, this is really very interesting. And I believe the Animal Welfare Act of 1985 actually had. And subsequent to that, I had all sorts of talks with people at NIH who basically said, yes, publicly we're going to oppose it, but you know, it's going to be great for us because it's going to allow us to go around saying we've got animal care committees and they function just like institutional review boards with respect to human experimentation. And they do. Every time I'm debating within the sector, they're always saying, I don't know what these animal people have said about the animals have the same protection that humans have. They have institutional review boards that say whether human experimentation is okay, and they have animal care committees who say that whether animal experimentation is okay. Of course, the difference is humans have to give informed consent, animals can't, and they can be used for all sorts of purposes you could never use humans for. So there's a huge qualitative distinction. But the Animal Welfare Act of 1985 was a great boon for vivisection, and it doesn't stop them from doing anything except introducing variables which are going to result in an inefficient use of this animal property. Okay? So basically, animals are economic commodities. And if we look at animal welfare, both historically and contemporary animal welfare campaigns, we see that these are based on the concept of efficient exploitation. That basically, the argument that's being made is, do this, it will actually make things better. It will improve your production efficiency. And it shouldn't surprise us that this is the only sort of thing that, I mean, think about it. If you're a producer, you're not going to spend. If something's worth a dollar and you can use it productively by spending 30 cents, your total cost of use is 30 cents and you're getting a dollar, you're not going to spend 35 cents to make that same dollar. That would be economically efficient. And as consumers, that is from a production standpoint, as consumers, how much makes some of us, affluent altruists or whatever, might say, all right, I'll pay a little bit more for, quote, humanely raised meat or something. But the bottom line is, most of us, if we really care about animals, so they'd really be willing to pay a lot more money for our animal products, we wouldn't be using them. If we really thought that much, if we really cared that much, if we really thought they had that much value, that we could impose that sort of cost on our use of them, I suggest to you, we wouldn't be using them. So, you know, from a production standpoint, consumption standpoint, and let me also say this. There's something in economics called elasticity of demand. That just has to do with how demand functions in response to increased costs. So, if the demand curve is inelastic, you can raise prices and people will still buy the product. For example, if you smoke a particular brand of cigarette, and you really like those cigarettes, they can raise the price, they can pay, and you'll end up spending less money on other items, and you'll buy that brand of cigarette. At some point in time, if it becomes too expensive, you'll switch, and you'll buy some sort of generic brand or whatever, or you might even stop smoking or whatever. But you know, the elasticity of demand for particular brands of cigarettes is quite inelastic. You can raise the price, people will still buy the cigarette. On the other hand, there are certain products that if you raise the price, people will shift to another product. This is called an elastic demand curve. If the demand curve is elastic, then price increases will result in changes in demand fairly quickly. If it's an inelastic demand curve, changes in prices will not result in demand changes, at least until you get a significant increase. For many animal products, demand is very inelastic. You can raise prices. People will continue to pay. The demand isn't going to change dramatically. But even if it does, if the price of animal products goes up, people don't, you know, if you look at the demand for a particular animal product, for cows or for sheep or, you know, for fresh beef or for fresh pork or something, even if the price goes up and people stop buying fresh beef and fresh, they don't buy tofu. You know, if you look at the demand for animal protein as a general matter, the demand is almost infinitely inelastic. You can keep raising prices and people will simply buy other animal products. So if you raise the price of beef too much, they'll buy chicken. If you raise the price of chicken, they may buy fish. Or they'll buy canned beef products. Or they'll buy canned pork products. Or they'll buy frozen stuff. Or they'll buy, you know, they don't buy tofu. This notion, you know, that I keep on hearing from animal welfare people, well, raise the price, they're going to eat vegetables. This is, I mean, I actually had a debate with some guys when I was, you know, there's a fellow fellow in Austria who was debating with me about this, and he basically said, well, you know, if you raise the price of animal size, people eat vegetarian food. And the answer is, no, they don't. They don't. You raise the price of animal products, and people buy other animal products. They don't buy tofu. They don't buy, you know, zucchinis. They say, well, you know, beef is a bit expensive this week, Henry. Let's have zucchinis. But they want that. It's crazy. That's naive. And the other thing that we've got to keep in mind, because it's an economic reality, is we now live in a world of free trade agreements, whether it's the European Economic Community, NAFTA, GATT, or whatever. So, like, you know, this guy I was debating with in Austria, he said, well, since they went to, since they got rid of battery cages in Austria, which they have to do under the European, there's a directive that says that the European community is supposed to get rid of battery cages by 2012. I'll talk about that in a second. That's never going to happen. But that's what the directive says. Austria has gotten rid of battery cages before, and he was claiming that the production of eggs fell 35% in Austria. Now, I haven't been able to find any evidence of that. As a matter of fact, all the statistics I have show that the production of eggs has actually gone up in Austria. It hasn't gone down. But even if it does, let's assume it went down 35%. What's going to happen? If there's a demand for battery eggs, for the cheaper eggs, they're going to come in from Poland, they're going to come in from Spain, and you can't stop them. Because under NAFTA, under GATT, under the European Community rules, you cannot stop an import of a product from a member nation simply on moral grounds. So you can't say, well, you know, we got rid of the battery cage, so we're not going to let Poland import. The answer is, no, it ain't going to happen. So, you know, keep in mind, animal exploitation, animal regulation, welfare regulation, basically makes animal exploitation more efficient. It doesn't increase production cost, it reduces production cost. It doesn't decrease output, it increases output. Okay? It doesn't decrease demand, it increases demand. But even if it didn't, even if welfare reforms had some effect on price, and that effect had some price on demand, it would still be the case that people are just going to turn to other animal products, number one, or they're going to demand the same product coming in from a market which is not regulated. So this just doesn't work. Okay? Now, I would also suggest to you, animal welfare regulations really do not result in significant protection for animals. There is a big campaign going on now. And I know there's people in Rochester involved with this Wegmans 8 campaign, and let's go cage-free, and let's go for, you know, free range, etc. I think it's nonsense. And this is not just in Rochester, it's all over the place. You know, I mean, vegan outreach, and HSUS, and everybody's promoting cage-free 8, free range 8. As far as I'm concerned, it is at best a fantasy. To tell people, and it is wrong, empirically wrong, to tell people that they are doing anything morally desirable by buying cage-free eggs or free-range eggs. I want to show you a 4-minute film made by the folks over at Peaceful Prairie, which is out in Colorado, and this is one of my dogs. She passed away last year. She's This only takes 4 minutes. Okay, we ready? I've got the thing on my screen. No, I've got the something else on my screen.
You certainly do.
Yeah, that's not what you have on the screen. Do you want to restart your computer?
Restart my computer.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm not. I won't. If you want to see it afterwards, we'll do it. I'm not going to let technology stop me. No way.
Just hold the switch to.
What?
No, that's
this is a map.
Okay. Just to write three times, we'll come back down. Just and then we keep talking.
Okay, while it is restarting, you know what? I'm gonna keep going, and then I will show this later, if it is wanted. I would suggest you, I have some brochures from Peaceful Prairie here. They have a sanctuary out in Colorado. They have farm animals there. And it's really an interesting place. They try to do...
No distractions.
Yeah, no distractions. What the film I was going to show you basically shows animals that they have rescued from a free-range situation. And, I mean, the idea, I have seen cage free facilities myself, and is there someone who just turned this thing off?
I'm walking in.
What?
Your screen came
on. Yeah, it's already here. Oh, it's
Hold on. Let's see if it goes. Perfect. No, hold on.
Oh, that's technology.
It's not.
It's a good thing we didn't have the people.
Nope. Okay.
You need a computer
to that. All right. I don't think that it makes any real difference. I've got some literature up here. If you want afterwards, we can figure out how to do it. I can show you the video. You can see the video by going to www.peacefulprairie.org. You can see the video. I think it's called Free Range Myth or something. And really, I mean, you watch it, you draw your own conclusions about whether you want to spend your time talking to people, telling them you can do the morally right thing by eating eggs from these tortured birds rather from these tortured birds. Don't make any sense to you. Maybe it's up to you. It's up to God. All right.
I also think that if you look at some of the animal welfare regulation, I mean, for example, look at the European Union.
You know, we hear from people like Peter Singer, organizations like Animal Rights International, some of the other animal groups. It's wonderful that the Europeans are so far ahead of us. They're getting rid of battery cages by 2012. Not that, first of all, it's never going to happen. Secondly, you know, a lot of nations in the EU, it's never going to happen. But number two, under the EU directive, you can have what they call enriched cages, which are basically battery cages with some straw in them. And that will, that's what people are calling is a great victory, tidal wave of progress, things like that. It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. There are a lot of loopholes in animal welfare legislation. For example, the California foie gras ban is a perfect example of, I cannot understand why anybody thinks that that's a victory for animals. It's a ban that's supposed to be coming into effect in California in 2012. It was supported by the guy who owns the only foie gras place in California, Sonoma, the Sonoma company. Why was it supported by him? Because it basically immunized what he was doing until 2012, and the legislation makes absolutely clear if they can come up with a more, quote, humane way, and they're doing experiments right now to show that there are more humane ways of force feeding geese, you know, by producing this product. That law is never going to come into effect. So it doesn't come into effect for, it was passed, I forgot when it was, 2003, I don't know when it was passed. It isn't going to come into effect until 2012. It probably will never come into effect. Look at the Chicago ban, which was repealed last week. I mean, a lot of these things are enforced. Look at Britain with the hunting ban. It is not enforced at all, and it's probably going to be repealed as soon as the Tories get into government. Anyway, and I think that basically these sorts of things have one great effect. If you want to talk about animal welfare having an effect, I'll tell you the effect it has. It makes people feel better about exploiting animals. It makes us feel better. Because we feel, hey, we're doing something right. Vegan outreach, you know, they hand it, you know, I met one of their representatives. They say, I should eat cage-free. We've got cage-free eggs in the college cafeteria. And we're doing the right thing. So what we're telling people is, yeah, this is a good thing to do. Eat cage-free eggs. This, you're actually reducing suffering. I suggest to you, if you could only, you know, see this video. Maybe you will sometime tonight. But if not, when you go home, if we can't figure out how to deliver it to you, when you go home tonight, you watch it. Draw your own conclusions about whether you want to spend your time trying to tell people that eating cage-free eggs is anything that you want to spend your time asking people to. Yeah, generally.
What I remember, Karen Davis from the Agriculture Concerns, she has the same point of view, right?
No, actually, I don't think she does.
Oh, she used to. Sorry, I'm not.
Okay. Anyway,
I think it's interesting. Farm Animal Net, which is a website that is sponsored by PETA, HSUS, and a couple other organizations, they had a big article about, it's wonderful, Strauss veal, biggest veal producer in the country, is going to get rid of, is going to phase out crates, veal crates. Go read the article and see what Randy Strauss, head of Strauss Lamb and Veal, I think is the name of the company, what he says basically is, we will increase the consumption of veal by getting rid of veal crates. And the studies show, again, that if you get rid of veal crates and you have the calves in slightly larger units, your veterinary costs go down, your production efficiency increases, and because you have to market this stuff as humane, per capita consumption increases. By the way, there's an article in the New York Times, not always known for accuracy, but nevertheless, the New York Times, 1961, world meat supplies was 71 million tons. 2007, 284 million tons. And before anybody says, yes, but in population has increased, per capita consumption of meat in that 46-year period has doubled. Per capita consumption has doubled. In any case, third point. Regulation does not lead to abolition. There is no empirical evidence whatsoever to suggest that animal welfare regulation causes people to think in an abolitionist way, that it moves us toward the abolition of animal exploitation. As a matter of fact, look, we had animal welfare for 200 years. Factory farming developed at a time when animal welfare was very, very popular in terms of Western thinking. We have more animals now being exploited in more horrific ways than at any time in human history. The idea that animal welfare regulations would lead to abolition is sheer fantasy. Fourth point, getting to the end. Fourth point. The idea that the abolitionist position is not normative, doesn't give us anything practical to do, is, again, wrong. The foundational premise of the abolitionist perspective is veganism. As far as I am concerned, veganism is the single most important form of social activism that anybody can engage in. And it's not a lifestyle thing. It has to do with a commitment to nonviolence, and it has to do with a commitment to the respect for persons, whether they are human persons or non-human persons. The title of my new book, which is quite deliberate, I mean, as most titles of books are, Animals as Persons. And I was trying to sort of bring out, this book is going to be out in two weeks. That, by the way, is one of our dogs, she's a Maltese, who was going to be killed because she had been returned to the shelter twice as non-house trainable. We have had her for 7 years. It is either the case that she has never had an accident, or she is so small we have never noticed it. But in any event, what Columbia University Press is publishing it. They gave me a bunch of flyers. They're giving pre-publication discounts, so let me get it. Before anybody asks the question, let me say, all of my book royalties last year they went to Feral Cats and to Peaceful Prairie and to other sorts of organizations like that. Don't think you're putting money in my box. Now, So, veganism is the principle of abolition applied to the life of the individual. I mean, it's what abolition is. I mean, just as an abolitionist of slavery would not own slaves, people who really believe we are about animal exploitation should not be consuming animal products. We shouldn't be eating them. We shouldn't be wearing them. We shouldn't be using them on our body. We simply shouldn't be doing that. And as I say, this is not a lifestyle thing. This has to do with nonviolence and respect for persons, human and non-human. And I want to get to the fact that when I say human, because I think veganism has a lot to do with human rights, just like it's got to do with the rights of non-humans. And it has a lot to do with respect for human persons, just as it has to do with respect for non-human persons. Things are never going to change. The society is never going to change. As long as we own them, as long as we're eating them, we ain't never going to find our moral compass while they're sitting there on our plate. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. It's important to understand that when welfare is talked about this two-track approach, it's all right to be vegan, but, it's like all right to be vegan, although, you have people who ascribe it as fanatical. You have people, the literature, the welfareist literature about veganism is, in my judgment, very, very disturbing. To the extent that when the welfareists say, we ought to promote regulation and we ought to promote veganism, first of all, I don't know why they're promoting regulation. I don't know what empirical evidence any of them has to show that welfareism does anything except increase production efficiency. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I don't understand why they do it. But what I do see happening is this notion that veganism is a way of reducing suffering, and so it's just like everything else. So whether you're a vegan, or whether you pass out literature about cage-free eggs, or whether you're in favor of some other welfare campaign, it's all the same. It's all lumped in. And I suggest to you that that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Yes, obviously, to the extent that veganism helps reduce suffering, yeah, I think it's a great idea. But I also think that it goes well beyond that. And as I said, it has to do with a real personal commitment. Well, I think these are the principle of nonviolence, and I think that really is sort of the center of what the movement ought to be. The idea that violence is not good, that violence is responsible for the mess that we are in this world right now, and that if we really want to think seriously about moral solutions, we need to be thinking about the principle of nonviolence, and we need to be thinking seriously about it. And nonviolence starts with what you stick in your mouth 3 times a day. And, it's really interesting, it's really great, to talk about nonviolence as some abstract thing while you're having, while you're having coffee in your New York cafe eating, a hamburger or, some meat. It's very interesting to talk about it, as an abstract matter. But you know what? It begins with what you stick in your mouth. And, if you start with violence 3 times a day, then the rest of it is all just mental masturbation, because they're not sort of sitting there. It was Ted Barnett who said that. It's interesting. I was just looking, and I quote this in the blog I'm about to publish, literature from vegan outreach and from Peter Singer, saying that we might actually even have an obligation not to be vegan. If other people think that, if it's going to make other people feel uncomfortable, for example, if we go to somebody's house and they produce something that's got animal products, or we go to a restaurant and we start quizzing the waiter or the service person or whatever, is this guy butter in it? Does it have cream in it? Does it have cheese in it? That we're just going to make people think, these people are fanatical. Now, what would happen if you were sitting in your, look, let's imagine you're sitting in your friend's house and your friend is showing family movies from the vacation. And all of a sudden, your friend says, let me show you a movie I took of the 6-year-old child next door, not wearing clothing. Would you say, I don't want to sort of be too fanatic about child molestation, so I'm just going to sit there? Or what if somebody tells a racist joke? Are we supposed to just sit there and say, I don't want to be politically correct? Or is the right thing to do saying, I don't like racist jokes. Please don't tell racist jokes. I don't want to hear racist jokes. And so I think this idea that, with respect to veganism, when it comes to animals, when somebody brings out, the meal that they've made and it's got cheese on it, you're supposed to say, hey, that's cool. I'll eat the cheese because I don't want anybody to think I'm fanatical. I don't want anybody to think, God forbid, should they think I'm consistent about my moral principles. And so I suggest that this way of sort of looking at things is really sort of very strange. Finally, I wanted to say something. It's a zero-sum game, by which I mean we live in a world of finite resources. And every resource, every dollar of resource, every dollar that we spend, every moment of labor that we spend promoting things like H3H is a moment that we're not spending engaged in social activism in the form of creative, nonviolent, vegan education. And you know, I was thinking before, because I was eating way too much of that food. And I did. And I was eating, I was engaging in gluttony before. And I was thinking, you know what activism is? This is activism. You know, I mean, yeah, we're a bunch of converts, so it's good. But, you know, I was thinking, activism is getting people to taste this stuff. Like, being at fairs and festivals and events and having this sort of stuff. Put your time into that. Put your mind into that. So people understand that, you know what, if they become vegan, they're not going to be, they're not going to be eating paper. It's really, really good. That's social activism. You know, that's social activism. Creative, nonviolent, vegan education. But it's a zero-sum game. If you've got 2 hours to spend tomorrow, you've got a choice, man. You either spend it passing out leaflets at the U of R saying, let's start the revolution, get your, commissary to have cage-free AIDS from less tortured birth. You know, is that really what the revolution is about? Or is what we want to do spending our time trying to convince students not to eat AIDS at all, not to eat dairy at all, not to eat meat at all? And you know what? It's going to, with a lot of people it's not going to work, but with some it will, and what we need to do is to build a political movement. It don't exist now. I mean, the existence of a movement that is opposed to inhumane treatment, it's worthless, it's useless. Everybody's opposed to inhumane treatment. I just came from Vanderbilt University, where I was talking with people who do animal research. And they say, they're opposed to inhumane treatment. And everybody, I've been working in the university for 25 years of my life. And everybody, I mean, who uses animals, they all agree. And they mean it sincerely. We ought not to treat them inhumanely. Everybody says that. Everybody agrees with that. So, I mean, the existence of a movement, if what the movement is a movement that is opposed to inhumane treatment, it is useless, it is meaningless. Final point. On education. People always say to me, if people do not want to go vegan, you talk to somebody, and if you really discuss this, and someone said, I want to go vegan, I just don't want to do it. Should you tell them, well, eat humane? And the answer is no. Never, ever, ever say that the consumption of animal products is ever anything that you put your imprimatur on that you think is morally alright. What I tell people when they say, look man, I agree with you, but I can't do this right away. I always say, okay, fine. Then, you really should, because eating this stuff is not good. But if you can't do it right away, what you ought to think about doing is, start off with breakfast vegan. Do that for a while. And then start, then go to lunch vegan. And then do dinner vegan. And then do all your snacks vegan. And then watch that beer and wine, because they eat a lot of our vegan, And so, get to your substance abuse and get that to be vegan. And then basically, work incrementally toward it, but never say that eating animals is okay. Never say to people that, oh yeah, you can be socially responsible. This is, I'm using this expression intentionally because this shows up in some of the, this was, I believe, the quote attributable to Paul Shapiro at HSUS, that cage-free agents, socially responsible thing to do. Never tell people that. Because what you're saying is, that's good. That's a good thing to do. Social responsibility is a good thing. So you're telling people, social responsibility, that's a good thing. When you have your Wegmans campaign, say, well, Wegmans, great organization, one glaring spot that they quote from someone, I was looking at it last night, one glaring oversight or one glaring thing or one glaring omission, I don't know what it was, something glaring. Glaring was the adjective, I don't know the noun. But the K3X. The fact that that we don't have to, that they're selling battery eggs. So let's get down to self, K3A. What does that say? It says, if Wegmans does this, it's good organization. Nonsense. Nonsense. That's complete nonsense. Okay? So, two other points. Single issue campaigns. People ask me about that all the time. What do I think about single issue campaigns? Then I'll take your questions. What do I think about single issue campaigns? I think they can be very dangerous because in a society where animal exploitation is the default position and is considered normal, focusing on one thing suggests that, you know, for example, when you focus on meat, in a society in which meat, dairy, and eggs are all considered normal things to do and that's all part of the default position, you focus on flesh, you're basically saying there's a morally relevant difference between flesh and, on one hand, eggs, dairy, on the other. When you talk about fur, you know, you talk about fur. I mean, I've always had problems with the fur campaign because I thought it was sexist. I thought it was, you know, yet another opportunity. It gives people another opportunity to go up to women on the street who are wearing things. You know, if you mean, you know, for some reason, it was never like a campaign to go up and sort of, you know, give people a hard time who were wearing leather jackets because people didn't want to lose their teeth. It was all right to go up to women who were wearing fur coats. And I always had problems with it. So, you know, my view is, you know, my view is when I ask the speakers these anti-fur things, to the extent that I do it, and when I did used to do it, I always said, as long as I can call it an anti-clothing event. Because as far as I'm concerned, there's no difference between fur and leather and wool. I mean, wool is actually horrible. I mean, the way wool is produced is absolutely horrible. And so, you know, I think these single issue campaigns are really problematic because they suggest that there's a more, like for the fur case, you know, it suggests that there's a more relevant difference between fur on one hand and leather and wool on the other, and there isn't. Final point, human rights, animal rights, there's a huge intersection. As far as, I mean, look, we are right now seeing food riots in the world. And you know, if I have to hear another NPR story about how the problem is ethanol, and the problem is demand for corn, is that a problem? You know what the problem is? The problem is animal agriculture. That's the problem. Because it takes between 6 and 12 pounds of plant protein to produce 1 pound of flesh. It takes 1,000 times more water to produce flesh than it does to produce potatoes or wheat. You know, we feed enough grain every day to animals in this country that we are going to slaughter. We can give 2 loaves of bread to every human being on the planet. I mean, you know what? I don't care if you don't care at all about animals. If you care about human animals, that's got to sort of be resonating somewhere that this is not right. This is not good. Because we are selfish and we eat animal products, we are condemning a substantial part of the world's population to starvation. And that is just wrong. And I think that we really do need to see. That's one of the reasons why I have a lot of problems with these sexist campaigns. As far as I'm concerned, speciesism is a lot like sexism. You know, I mean, I really think that, you know, as long as we're treating women like pieces of meat, we're going to treat meat like pieces of meat. So, I mean, I do not know. I mean, I used to work with PETA. I mean, I was a lawyer. I was, as a matter of fact, I was like their first sort of like regular lawyer. You know, I met the PETA people in the early 80s and worked with them. And one of the things, there were two things that basically caused an end to that relationship. One was the killing of healthy animals at the Aspen Hill Sanctuary, which occurred. The fact that PETA kills animals at its Norfolk facility, apparently, from what I've been reading, is really no surprise. It's been going on for a long time. There was that, and there was the issue of I'd rather go naked than wear fur. It never made sense to me. I never understood why we wanted to eroticize the fur issue, why we wanted, you know, sexism is a problem. And you know, really, you know, the relationships between pornography and meat eating are very, very close. And so I think that, you know, we really need to be thinking about that. But as far as the food issue is concerned, it ain't ethanol we've got to be worried about. It's the fact that China and India are increasing their meat production, or their meat demand, by you know, billions of percentage points. And that we all eat this stuff. And that rich Western nations are condemning a lot of people in the world to starvation because of selfishness. I think this raises very, very important issues. I think it's all part of the same puzzle. I think it's all part of the same problem. I think ahimsa, nonviolence, is the answer to all of it. And now I am done, and I will get the answer to it.
Any questions, I would like to make a presentation. At Gary's request, we have our honoraria made out to peaceful prayers.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you very much.
To look at his website. It's on here. EvolutionsApproach.com. It's got everything he just talked about.
What I have on that website is I've got 4 video presentations. Theory of Animal Rights, Rights vs. Welfare, Animals as Property, Animal Law. I've got them in English, French, German, Portuguese, and Spanish. And I've got blog essays, which are basically why animal welfare is equivalent to, like, vampires or something. The criticism of animal welfare. And then I've got an FAQ section in which I answer questions like, what about abortion? What about insects? What about plants? What about, blah, blah, blah. It's sort of like, they're canned answers that you can, that you can use when you're talking to people in terms of answering the sorts of questions that come up. Who would you say if you were, like, in the burning house? That sort of thing. Because we all get that sort of stuff, Well, if you're walking by the house, who would you say, the human or the animal, the burning house? The answer is I try to say both, but let's assume, I can only say, one, and I chose to say the human. What does that tell me about what it's, whether it's okay to exploit the animal? He says, it doesn't tell you anything about it. Any more than it does, if every time I'm walking by the burning house, I see a young person and a very old person, if he's 115, and I know he's going to be dead. If I would only say the young person simply because of, on the basis of, the person's got his or her whole life ahead of him or her, that doesn't mean it's all right to use elderly people in certain services, rodeos, zoos, or even. But it's like those sorts of responses. Anyway, do you have any questions?
Yes.
I was listening to a lecture by Carol Cohen about why animals don't have rights.
And yeah.
He spent most of the lecture talking about research and the need for animals in research so that we can get immunization,
etc.
Would you see a point in even conceding something like that?
Nope.
Okay. Because the average animal board may say, that's so important. They have these immunizations. And they're only 1% of all animals killed.
You ask a very, very good question. And in the book that I have coming out, I have a chapter on experimentation. And I make the point that it's interesting, if you look at the movement in Britain and in America in the 19th and 20th centuries, there's a real focus on vivisection. And, we all claim to agree with the principle of unnecessary suffering, that's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals. Now, we can have an interesting philosophical discussion, which we don't have time to have, but we can have an interesting discussion on what necessity means, but whatever it means, it's got to mean, at least as a minimal matter, that it's wrong to inflict suffering or death for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. But yet, 99.9% of our animal use can only be justified by human amusement, pleasure, or convenience. Namely, our eating of animals, our use of animals for entertainment, our use of animals for sport hunting, etc. The only use of animals which is not transparently frivolous, although I don't agree with it, is the use of animals to cure important human illnesses. I don't agree with it. I want to make it clear. I don't agree with it. I just think you need a more complicated sort of analysis on that, because there's a situation where people really do perceive there to be a conflict situation. There isn't a conflict situation in any of these other situations. So it's interesting, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you have this very, very weird sort of focus on vivisection. And I think it has to do with the fact that animal people have historically not wanted to be vegans. So it's easy to say, hey, I'm an anti-vivisectionist. And so, you have all these weird situations in England, in the 19th century where, they have these really sometimes violent demonstrations against vivisection in London, and then they all go out and they eat meat. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, we don't know people who do vivisection. Those of us who, I know a lot of vivisectors because I work in a university. If you don't work in a university, you don't meet a whole lot of vivisectors. It's not like they're vivisectors crawling all over the place. We're not confronted with them socially. So we don't really, and they're easy for us to make abstract enemies out of. What I always tell people is look, I always focus on the eating issue. And I will talk about vivisection, but I always try to steer the discussion over to eating. But when people want to discuss it, I discuss it. And I always say, look, let's take animals out of the equation.
Let's imagine you could find a cure for cancer by using mentally, you know, disabled people. Would that be okay? And, you know, and sometimes you get, you know, you're at a party and you're talking to some university people and they get a few drinks in them and they'll say, well, you know, I really wouldn't think that was a bad thing. But most of those people, you know, I'm not kidding, but by and large, I mean, people don't say that that's a good thing. As a matter of fact, most people think it's really monstrous. Most of us think, or many of us think, That not only is that wrong, but we have a special obligation to more vulnerable humans. That if somebody, I think it's important, because I think what we miss with that is it doesn't capture the morality. It doesn't capture the moral view that many of us have, that we feel we have special obligations to be really vulnerable humans. And I think we have really special obligations to non-humans, in part because of their vulnerability. But I think that, you know, basically you've got to put that person, you know, you got to really sort of put the question to that person. Would you use a mentally disabled person? I mean, what is it, why is it that you think it's all right to use animals? And, you know, they'll give you some sort of nonsense. Well, you know, they can't reason, they can't think. Well, you know, I think that's wrong. I think that as a matter of evolutionary theory, that's probably wrong. One of the things Darwin said, whether he's right or wrong about it, one of the things that Charles Darwin said is that the distinction between human and other animals is a distinction of degree and not kind. It's a quantitative distinction, not a qualitative distinction. As a matter of fact, Darwin rejected the use of the expression higher and lower animals. You see? And so, what is it that makes, you know, for Carl Cohen, what is it, Carl, that makes it okay to use them? And you get Carl, and basically, Cohen, I mean, I know Cohen's views, and Cohen's views are basically because they can't act in morally reciprocal ways. Is basically, it's a sort of a Kantian argument, that they can't, you know, they can't engage in moral reciprocity. And the answer is, lots of humans can't do that either. Lots of humans are incapable of acting in morally reciprocal ways. Does that mean it's all right to use them as forced organ donors? I mean, anyway. Yes?
Do you have any hope for evolution?
I have no hope. I have no hope.
I'm under capitalism. I mean, how capitalist does that project?
Are you a communist? Do you realize? Do you understand? Do you understand there are Republicans sitting in front of us? They're all within striking distance. The question is, do I have any hope of the situation improving and of our achieving abolition under capitalism? That's an interesting and complicated question. I think, in theory, it would be just as you could get rid of chattel slavery. We have a capitalist society. We don't have chattel slavery. We exploit people. We exploit people in the Marxist sense of exploitation. We alienate people from the value that they, you know, I mean, when you work, you get paid only a portion of what your labor is worth. I, the capitalist, take the rest of it, and I appropriate, and I alienate you from your labor. So that exists, but we don't have chattel slavery. It is, in theory, possible that we could eliminate the chattel slavery of non-humans in our society, but I do think you have hit upon an important thing. We need to be more critical of capitalism as an economic system. We need to be more critical of capitalism. Capitalism creates a lot of mischief. And there are good arguments for example, we live in a society, one of the few, that doesn't regard health care as a basic right. So that people like Barnett can make lots of money. Now we're starting to change a little bit, and we're starting to say, well, gee, you know, maybe it would be good if we had a more socialized healthcare system. But yet, the expression socialized medicine is something, is an expression that isn't even used in the political discourse because it is so charged. But we really do need to be looking at capitalism a bit more critically. However, having said that, we got rid of chattel slavery in a capitalist economy. We could, in theory, get rid of animal slavery in a capitalist economy.
I've been rethinking. I've been a member of Peter for a long time, but I've been thinking of dropping out because I'm upset about this latest publicity stunt where I'll offer $1 million to somebody who clones meat in the laboratory.
Yeah.
And I'm also upset that they wanted to kill the fighting dogs.
Yeah, my goodness.
They were closed by best friend, the animal sanctuary. Are you still a member, PETA?
No.
Okay, answer the other question. No. What do you think of the wacky $1 million?
Well, I mean, I was asked to comment on it, and I basically said, first of all, they're not risking any money because the idea that there's going to be commercially viable quantities of in vitro meat by 2012 is ridiculous. Number two, the idea that you have an animal rights organization, there was no limit on, as far as I know, there was no limit on the use of animals because you have to use animals to in various ways to develop those products, you know, whether it's the media that you're growing the cells in or, you know, I mean, and so animal use is involved. And I just think, you know, PETA has become a gimmick organization. You know, it stopped a long time ago being an animal organization. It's got nothing to do with the animals. It has to do with PETA. And you know, it's for the promotion of PETA. PETA is one big publicity stunt after another one. As far as the Michael Vick situation was concerned, I actually wrote about that. I think the Michael Vick thing has nothing to do with anything but racism. You know, we're all sitting around saying, well, Michael Douglas, you know, Michael Vick, you know, like the O.J. Simpson business. Oh my God, not even married to a blonde woman. It's frightening. They're getting close. And I think the O.J. Simpson thing was racist. I think the Michael Vick thing was racist. There's no difference between sitting around watching fighting dogs and sitting around your barbecue pit, you know, having hamburgers. I don't think there's any difference whatsoever except one's a rich black guy doing it. And so I don't, you know, and I just got tired of that Michael Vick thing. I mean, and I certainly don't think, I was doing a radio show. And I was asked, was I in favor of killing those dogs? And I said, absolutely not. I said, you know, I'm a great believer, for example, with Cesar Millan and has done with pit bulls at his place in Los Angeles. And I called on PETA on the radio show. I said, look, you know, I don't know how much money PETA's now like a multi. I think they're like a 60. I don't remember what they're. I do know that HSUS, the organization which is so horribly concerned about suffering, is sitting on top of $250 million. You know how much money that is? $250 million. Lots of suffering. You can stop with that money. And they're taking in $125 million a year. And what I did was I said, look, why doesn't PETA use some of the, you know, X thousands, X millions of dollars that it has in getting those animals, you know, in helping those animals to overcome their aggressive tendencies, because you know what, that can be done. And that can be done without violence. Cesar Millan does not use violence. And at least as far as I'm aware, and what I've read and seen of him, he does not use violence. And so I think they should have done
something. Is the trainer Oprah Winfrey?
I have no idea.
Got to teach her dog not to do something.
I have no idea. He's a dog mentor. He's an interesting guy. He's an interesting guy.
What about, that was a minor approach, teaching people to become vegans because of health issues?
Yeah.
I'm a nurse, and I belong to a group of people called who am I? Colors, to say the least, but we are on a diet called the Hallelujah Diet.
Yeah.
You're familiar with it.
No.
The pastor George Malcolm. And what it is a vegan diet. We do 85% raw most of the time.
Yeah.
Juicing a lot, that kind of thing. And he has books and a lot of information teaching people that meat, chicken, fish, dairy products, all that, eggs, everything, are really a detriment to your health.
Yeah.
And I found a lot of people are very interested in listening to this, at least, and maybe, you know, trying it. And his organization is getting humongous all over the world. I mean, he is a growing community of people that are becoming vegan and for health issues, and also because they care about animals and don't want them to suffer.
I certainly, when I talk to people about this, I always mix the moral issue, the environmental issue, and by the environmental issue, I'm not talking just about, you know, I mean, I'm not an ecologist in the sense that I do not believe that plants or ecosystems have any interest. I think that only sentient beings have interests, and that we can only have obligations to sentient beings.
And so I think that, but I talk about the environmental issues because I think that the resource allocation that is involved in the meat-based or animal protein-based diet is horribly bad for the environment, but also it has bad effect on people. And I talk about health. I mean, I talk about the fact that, you know, we're all taking drugs for high blood pressure, for cholesterol, for this, for that, but we could be dealing with these issues in a natural way through eating healthy, whole foods. I don't know the person you're talking about, but there are been people around for a while. As a matter of fact, Ted Barnett, you know, has been talking about this stuff for a long time. There are people like Joel Furman. There are people like, who's the other guy who shows up at Summerfest all the time? Colin, yes. And there's Milton Mills. So there have been a number of people who have been talking about it. And I think it's important. The only issue I have with sort of really focusing on health issue exclusively is because the meat and animal protein industry is a huge business. You know, if you want to make the argument rise or fall on the health argument, you know, I mean, they've got more money. So anytime we're saying this is bad for you, they can come back and they can say this is good for you. And they really brainwash people to the point where, you know, a large part of our population still believes that they don't eat animal protein, their arms and legs are going to fall off, and they're going to go fly, you know, I have a lot of young people that I teach at Rutgers, and I go to other universities and I talk, and I always have kids come up to me and say, you know, are you a vegan? I say, yeah, I'm a vegan. How long have you been a vegan? For 26 years. I say, you know, how do you feel? At the end of this month, I'm going to be 54 years old, and I have more energy than most of these 26-year-olds, and I think a large part of it is I don't eat processed foods, I don't eat any animal protein, I eat mostly white, some cooked. But I think that has a lot to do with, you know, sort of I teach in university, people sneezing on me all the time. I never get excluded. I think that probably has to do with, I don't know, but I think it probably has to do with my vegan diet. But the thing that is that, I think we ought to talk about the health issue, but I think, you know, really the important issue to me is the moral issue, the non-violence part. Because I have to be honest with you.
Do that as well.
Well, yeah, and that's fine. But I always say to people, look, let me be real frank with you, just so you understand where I'm coming from. If it were necessary for me to eat optimally healthy, to lead an optimally healthy life, I still wouldn't do it because I'm much more concerned about a different aspect of my life. I'm much more concerned about my moral life in many ways than I am, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, I'm concerned about, to me, violence is a serious problem, and I think that's really real.
Gary, just to speak to that healthy one, yeah. The war, I think it's important, though, to have examples of humans who have lived all their life as vegan.
Absolutely.
To be able to point them and say, look, you know, you can do this. Because I think, as you said, there are people out there who think their arms and legs are going to fall off if they don't eat animal products. The fact that they're doing the surgery should not have a port of business someday. You know, they're all going to die in the family.
Right.
You know, I think it's important for people to know that this experiment's been done. We can survive.
No, I would say that, and you know, the thing I would find, and you probably get the same thing, is people say, where do you get your B12 from? And I would say, look, what is this mystery? You get your B12 from meat, I get my B12 from yeast. You got to get it from somewhere. So, like, the fact that you get it from one food and I get it from another food doesn't make the fact that if you give up this source, then there's something deficient about what you're going to do. Because it simply means you get it from another plant source. That's all. Sure.
Yeah, a couple things. I was wondering what your stance on the Animal Liberation Front is, and coupled with that, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and then coupled with that, the 2.3 million people who are imprisoned right now in this country be used for basically slaves for corporations.
Well, look, I think it's appalling. I mean, you're raising a whole bunch of
people.
Okay. He wants to know about, your name is Ted, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Ted wants to know about what my views are about the prison system in the United States, which involves millions of people who are basically being imprisoned by now private corporations who are using them for-profit purposes. And he wanted to know how I feel about the Animal Liberation Front, and he wanted to know how I feel about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. As far as the prison system is concerned, As I said, I teach criminal law and criminal procedure. I think it's horrible that what is happening in this country in terms of the privatization of the criminal justice system, and the fact that you have the Corrections Corporation of America, CCI, and some other corporations who basically, they are corporations that run prisons. Prisons are being run by corporations which are using and exploiting prison labor. I think it's horrible. But I also think even before that, our criminal justice system was rotten. We've always had two criminal justice systems, for the rich and the middle class, and for the poor. Well, the rich don't have to worry at all, they get away with whatever they want to get away with. But the middle class, they have a criminal justice system, and then the poor people got nothing. And the criminal injustice system. And so even before it became corporatized, I think there have been problems with it. As far as the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is concerned, I mean, really, what do you expect in a society which is as paranoid as this one is now? When you get people from animal organizations going on 60 Minutes saying, I think it's all right to kill vivisectors. I thought that was crazy, and I thought what it did was hand the government an excuse for something like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. What do I think about the Animal Liberation Front? I'm opposed to all violence. I think that it is, I don't believe that it is right to fire. People ask me, well, what happens if the building is completely empty? Is it all right for us to firebomb? I'm going to on tape say, but let me say this. First of all, I'm a lawyer. I can't tell people to write the break law. But let me just say, as a non, from a moral point of view, there's no such thing as firebombing a building or burning down a building in which you do no harm. There are animals that live in that building. You're burning that building. You burn down an empty building which is going to be used for vivisection, you're going to kill a lot of animals. If you engage in illegal activities, oftentimes what happens with these liberations, or what can happen with these liberations, is you encounter people who are working in these places as security guards. This sets up a confrontational, possibly violent situation. I don't believe in violence. It's a zero-sum game. You want to know how to efficiently put our, you want to know how to efficiently use resources. If we all spent time, if you took all the time and the energy, I remember saying this in 1985 when we had a big meeting of, the large animal groups that existed at that time, and the issue was actually 1984, and the issue was whether or not we were going to support the Animal Welfare Act of 1985, which I thought was a very bad idea. I thought it was a very stupid piece of legislation for a lot of different reasons. And I said, look, if we take all of our money and we put it into creative, nonviolent, vegan education, and we've done that in 1985, that we'd be sitting here now in 2008, and we have, I think conservatively speaking, a few hundred thousand more vegans than we have now. We put all of that money, we're talking about hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars, if we put that into an unequivocal, clear vegan campaign. We have a political movement. We have the beginning of a nonviolent political movement for the liberation of animals that was really going to do something. Because let me tell you something. There is no context to this liberation stuff. The comment that, what's your name?
Chris.
Chris. The comment that Chris made. We live in a society where 99.9% of the people think it's all right to kill animals for the purpose of eating them because they taste good. When people go in and steal animals from laboratories, or they burn down buildings, or they threaten vivisectors, or they get in confrontations with vivisectors in which there's physical violence, you're attacking the one use of animals that isn't transparently frivolous. I don't agree with it. I think all vivisection is wrong, and I wouldn't kill one mouse to find a cure for cancer. No. But there's no social context in which those acts can have any sort of meaning. All it does is make us look like a group of lunatics, because we live in a society in which people think it's all right to have rodeos, in which people think it's all right to have circuses and zoos and eat hamburgers and hot dogs and all sorts of things which can't be described as anything but frivolous. So I don't see how the Animal Liberation Front, and what really bothers me is a lot of these Animal Liberation Front people aren't even vegans. They're not even vegans. And I have always found that to be, I think the Animal Liberation Front has a lot to do, I'm sorry, I'm not directing this at you, I have no idea what you're, I think it has a lot to do with sophomoric, very immature, thinking. And I think that, you know, it's a lot of bravado and a lot of, you know, hey, wow, you know, this is cool, you know, we're shaping the bar. And the answer, I think it's assertive. And I think a lot of it, I think it's counterproductive. I don't think there's any social context for it. And most importantly, I am totally opposed to violence. I think violence is wrong. I don't think there's any such thing as that sort of activity which doesn't put human and non-human lives at risk. Other questions?
Here's the problem. They're going to close this building at 9:30. So, why don't people have questions?
9:45.
Okay.
What time is it now?
What do I do for the 15 minutes? Yeah, that's great. If anyone wants to feel very okay at the meeting, this is a good time. We'll maybe get a close right to over again.
Actually, if you leave now, he's going to be photographing you. I'm the one. Yes.
Sure. So, Jeff, you said that when people do go out, start and
I'll
point out,
shout. Okay. Okay. We're going to take out the building. We're going to go into the start. Okay.
Ted, it's something to address your thing about why would the animal industry be inefficient? Right. A certain metric built into all the animal user industries, which is an attrition rate of 20% of all the livestock herds. Right. Between disease, transport stress, and basically injury or loss. So it doesn't matter what the animal is, there's basically an attrition rate of 20% in all those, but that's picked up at the back end.
My question always was that, from their standpoint, they need more money that way. That was always my question. From that standpoint, that wasn't
making profit is picked up by the meat packing industry. So as much as they may think, they just assume that the practice has shown the machine is built in such a way that they're going to lose 20% of all those animals between birth and slaughter. So it's just building the practice that costs them, because they assume they pick up the cost.
Yes.
I have a couple of very quick questions. Number one, vitamin D.
Yeah.
So D3 is better than D2.
Well,
apparently D3 gives only like 2/3 of what D3 is.
So you just take one D2. I'm aware of that, and a lot of people don't know D3 is called calciferol. She's saying that D3 is better than D2. D3 is cholecalciferol, D2 is ergocalciferol. Ergocalciferol is plant-based D2. Cholecalciferol D3 is animal-based. It's generally from sheep, wool. And anybody who tells you that doesn't involve suffering or death is lying to you, because a lot of the D3 is made from animals that are being slaughtered. And the whole process of shearing animals, if you've ever seen it, is really quite brutal. So the idea that it's really just, you know, fun, that they know it's like the sheep are sort of lining up and saying, no, shear me again, it's nonsense. But I have heard, or I have read, that D3 is less, that people have absorbed D3 better than they do D2. So just take more D2. I mean, I buy vegan D2. And I take more of it. I don't have any D3 deficiency. The people none of my vegan friends have D3, have vitamin D deficiencies. They just say if you don't have enough D, you just take more D2. So you have to maybe take more than D3. Okay.
Well, it's just really, if you don't like to take pills,
The problem is there are a lot of things that we could do like using mathematical models, using computer models, using alternatives to animals, using men in experiments. The problem is that as we get more, I mean, we're using more animals in vivisection than we used to because we're doing all this genome stuff and genetic engineering stuff, and because we all want to live forever, we're doing the stem cell stuff, and so we're actually increasing the numbers of animals that we're using. But you know, could we have alternatives? And the answer is yeah. The problem is the alternatives are not really keeping pace with the demand for new uses of animals. That's the problem.
Because there's so many new machines that are more technologically.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I submit, Gary, that animal research has nothing to do with cures or anything like that. It has to do with money.
Sure it does. Well, sure.
If the money incentive was taken out of animal research, it would probably come to a dent.
Well, but you know, look, I think, you know, there used to be a guy, I think he's now passed away, named Hans Bloch. And he took the position that animal experiments, you know, the use of animals, we didn't learn anything from the use of animals in biomedical research. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, and you know what? To me, it's irrelevant. And so, I don't want to get into an argument with somebody about, you know, because the Roycians get really upset when you say, well, you know, we may have learned something from the use of animals. They go, well, how could that be? And, you know, the answer is, maybe we haven't, and we can talk about to what degree the profit, you know, incentive has to, you know, how much the, you know, the profit incentive has to do with it. We can talk about that. And I'm sure that you're right. But in order to make the point to people, I don't think we need to convince them of that, because in a sense, you really sort of need to, you could make the same comment about a lot of practices in our society. And then you start getting to the question Adam asked before. What are the restrictions about really change, moral change in a capitalist society? And then, you know, then you really are now in a very, very sort of abstract space, and you're now not talking any longer about the exploitation of non-humans or how the exploitation of non-humans relates to the exploitation of humans. You're now talking about, you know, whether or not we should overthrow the capitalist system, and that is something, I mean, I'm not sure that's a discussion that we really are ready to have in our society, because if anything, if you look at our current political campaign, even the candidates on the Democratic side are really quite conservative, are proposing quite conservative positions. So the idea, I mean, Barack Obama is the nominee of the Democratic Party, I will vote for him because I'm a Democrat and I would rather see anybody other than John McCain president. But on the other hand, to analogize Barack Obama to Martin Luther King is, in my judgment, not an appropriate analogy, because look at their positions. They're really very different people in terms of what their positions are. Barack Obama is considerably more conservative. So I think, in a sense, we're not really ready to have a discussion in the society about whether we should dramatically change our economic system. I think there are very good reasons, very good arguments for why we ought to. But I think that's something that really sort of, I'm not sure we need to get there in order to sort of make the point that we want, you know, make the point that we want to make. But I certainly don't disagree with what you said.
And the second part to that, of course, I wanted to say was, and I believe you would find very little difference in results, simply because everything goes through clinical trials and research.
Sure.
In the end. And
sure. I mean, the bottom line is, however many animals you're using, you got to try it on somebody first.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, look, I think animal research is a primitive, putting aside the moral issues, as a matter of science, it's a barbaric, primitive way of finding answers to problems. And it's so imprecise. I mean, one of the things I talk about in one of the chapters of this book is I talk about all of the problems with the use of animals in experiments just from a scientific point of view. I mean, for example, if you use different testing methods, you get different results. If you use different species, you get different results. I mean, it's such an imprecise, such a sloppy, such an inexact, such a primitive way of getting data that, you know, I mean, one wonders why intelligent people would be attracted to it, and I guess
they get paid.
They get paid. But obviously, if you had a different incentive, I mean, it sort of becomes circular, because if you had a different incentive structure, economic people would be responding to that. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've known a lot of business sectors over in my lifetime, and I think some of them actually do really struggle with this. I think they really believe. I think a lot of them, I mean, some of the ones I've met are clearly mentally problematic individuals who enjoy inflicting pain. But I also think there are a lot of people who really think this is the right way to do science, and they struggle with it. I tell you something. I once had a very interesting conversation with somebody who worked in a drug company doing animal tests, and he was a vegan. And he was a vegan for moral reasons. And when I asked him about this, he said, I do animal testing because I believe it's necessary, and I really think scientifically it's justified. I don't eat animals, I don't eat meat or dairy, because I don't think that's necessary. And so, you know, I mean, it's complicated. It's complicated. But, yeah.
I definitely am going with animal rights versus animal
rights,
but I'm still navigating through all that.
Sure.
And I guess where I'm struggling sometimes would be trying to deal with the immediacy of the suffering, you know, the primacy of what's going on today.
But how is the welfare, what's your name?
Well, John.
John, how is the welfare regulation? I mean, let's look at the case.
Well, I want to go to the case. They've been very passive audience, watching everything. And I was to speak to them and say, you know, you and your future generations are going to have to suffer in that small cage, because if I go for welfare reform and give you a little bit bigger cage, you'll suffer less, but more of your brethren are going to be suffering. The industry's going to grow for generations, so you're going to just have to suffer, and I'll try to hopefully deplete the industry through vegan abolition. So it's tough, because I have to face them and say, you're going to have to put up with sacrifice.
Well, but John, first of all, you're assuming, for example, this is an argument I had when I was in Europe recently with people who were talking about the directive to get rid of battery cages by the European Union. It's not clear to me that there's a hell of a lot of difference between a battery cage and one with a bit more straw. And it's not clear to me that there's a difference between taking them out of that cage and sticking them into, I mean, a cage where there's 30,000 of them crawling all over each other, urinating on each other, crushing each other. It is not clear to me at all. And I think I would get to the point where I would be anthropomorphizing if I said, well, you know, I looked at those chickens, and those chickens are telling me, I'd rather be in a large cage. You know, I mean, I think it does become anthropomorphic. And I think that also what you're doing in the meantime is by encouraging people to believe that eating cage-free eggs is a morally acceptable solution, you're actually increasing net suffering, because even if you're reducing suffering a bit more, if you're causing demand to go up because people feel better about eating these products, you may be increasing net suffering. So, you know, I just think, again, it's a zero-sum game. You've got 2 hours tomorrow. You're going to have to spend that 2 hours, you know, trying to talk to people on your campus about eating cage-free eggs and getting the dining facility to do cage-free, or talking to people about veganism. And it's zero sum. Every bit of time you spend it on a regulation, it's time you're not spending on vegan education. And so that choice you've got to make, but I suggest to you, there's a trade-off there. And so when I understand the whole thing about the immediacy of suffering, what I suggest to you is welfareism is not doing anything to deal with that immediacy of suffering, except make people feel better about it. You know, I really do. Go home tonight, please. When you go home tonight, log on to Peaceful Prairie Sanctuary. And look at their, I think it's called the free range myth, I think that's what it is. Is that the name of the video?
Yeah.
Look at that video and ask yourself whether or not we're doing those birds any favor. Just ask yourself that question. Yeah.
Real quick question.
Yeah.
How do you answer the argument? So I get this all the time, that we can't basically promote this. You can't spend a lot of money in education because it isn't a quantifiable return. That's why we won't spend money on it.
Well, the reality is the welfarists do not want to spend money on education because they would rather have meaningless campaigns that they can win, like the Flop Rock Band in California, and then go out and do fundraising. Or the gestation crate thing in Florida. Like two producers in Florida that were even using gestation crates, both of them were going out of business. And then huge subsidies from the state, or eligible for huge subsidies from the state. And then basically, what's happening is that you get these large organizations going after meaningless campaigns so they can fundraise. Every time I go to my mailbox, there's a billion pieces of mail. Well, you know, everybody taking credit for the same thing and saying, activism. You know what activism is? Sitting down and writing a check to our organization. That's what activism is. They have really turned us into a bunch of check writers, and that has become activism and it's nothing. So when they say it's not education isn't quantifiable, you know what? Those of us who are in education can tell you. That is nonsense. You may not be able to quantify it in the same degree that you can quantify the welfare of the victory. But if the welfare is victory, you can multiply, 7,000 million, or, 7 billion times zero is still zero. Yeah, any other questions?
I just have a question here.
Yeah.
I'm moderating, but it's kind of my problem. Where is the difference between abolition and welfare? It seems like the conversation has to take place in a different location. For example, welfare can take place within the grocery store. So you can try to influence people at the grocery store. That's where the competition takes place.
But where, you know what?
The conversation about abolition takes place.
Oh, it takes place at the grocery store. For example, when I go to Whole Foods, I shop at Whole Foods because that's where I get my vegetables. Not all the time, but sometimes. And I go there and I always wear one of my Vegan Freak t-shirts. Vegan Freak is a website and podcast. And I always wear my Vegan Freak t-shirt because somebody always asks, what's that? What's that mean? And I'll talk to anybody. And so, I will have conversations with people. And I have a lot of conversations with people. And let me tell you something about Whole Foods. When I first started shopping at Whole Foods, we talked fresh peels. That's what it was called, 12 years ago or whatever. They didn't sell any fresh corpses. They sold meat products. But they didn't sell meat and fish and fresh chicken and all that stuff. They didn't sell that sort of stuff. And they had a lot of vegan stuff, and they didn't have, a salad bar with all this meat stuff. They've been getting more and more. Now they all have big meat counters, and they have big signs that say, humanely raised. And I guess it was last year. It was a while back, but I was walking through Whole Foods. And I see a kid who was a young guy who was working in the grocery section. They moved him over to the fish section. And I saw the guy and I said, oh my God, they got you selling these horses. And he said, yeah, I know. He said, but Peter gave us an award. And this is a circus. This is really very, and Peter Singer signed a letter, Dear John letter. Dear John, we love you. Thank you for your compassionate attitudes towards animals. And then, signed by Peter Singer, and with the support of PETA, Vegan Outreach, and a lot of other organizations. What the hell is that? You want to talk about confusion. This is confusing people, because you know what? If you aren't into this, if you aren't sitting here tonight, if you're like a normal human being who doesn't know anything about this stuff, and you're concerned, you say, well, Peter Singer and PETA, they say that this stuff is good, so what the hell are you hiring me for? I'm doing the right thing. I'm going to Whole Foods. I'm buying my compassionately raised corpses and my cage-free aid. What the hell do you want me for? But I do disagree with you. The discussion about abolition happens everywhere. I had it happen to me in vet offices. Vet offices are great, but I can't tell you. I hate going to the vet because my animals don't like it, but it's a great place to have a discussion because you're sitting there with other people who are concerned about their dog or cat. You're also concerned with your sick dog or cat, and it's so easy to start a conversation in a situation like that. You say, yeah, wow, what's wrong with your cat? Oh, you say, oh, wow, that's really horrible. My dog's got we have a discussion, and I say, isn't it interesting how we're sitting here with our dogs and our cats, and we're going to go home and we're going to stick forks into other animals? I do that all the time. And so the abolitionist discussion can happen anywhere you want it to happen. It's just a question. I mean, I'm in Lion Hope, and I got my vegan green t-shirt on, and somebody says, what does that mean?
Ooh,
as long as you got enough stuff in your car, or at least as long as the person in front of you is like that lot of stuff is in the work cart, so it's going to take a while. I got you now. And it's just a matter of time. You can have that discussion with people.
So this discussion is no longer with the management of the grocery store, right? It's now a discussion with the customers.
The manager of the grocery store is basically a business store.
Right, but they can, see, when you're talking about welfare, then they can step up, so if they didn't think of themselves, there's still something to sell.
It's something for them to sell, yeah, but I don't
tell them not to sell something. That's the whole, when you get out of the capitalism part, that's the whole problem. You're telling someone not to...
But wait a minute, Ted, the problem isn't the seller. The problem is the customer who demands it. These people would be selling lawn chairs if that's what the demand was for. They're, capitalists are indifferent to what the demand is for. The capitalists only care if the demand shifted, the investment of capital would shift. So capitalists are indifferent to what they're selling. I mean, so the problem really isn't when people talk about animal exploiters and they talk about animal industries, but, you know, as if those are the evil people. You know, yeah, those people are doing bad stuff. Why are you doing bad stuff? Because we demand it. We want it. If we didn't buy it, if we didn't demand it, they wouldn't be putting their capital into it. They'd be putting it into lawn chairs, or they'd be putting it into something else. You know, they'd be investing their money in widgets. They wouldn't be investing their money in the courses and the cow bus. They only do that because that's what we demand. And I think it's really, what I really love is when I talk to animal people who aren't vegan, and they're busy talking to me about how evil the exploiters are. And I want to say, let's have a little self-reflection here. You know, you're the one who's demanding this stuff. You're the one who's buying this stuff. I mean, I always tell people, when they tell me, you know, I say, you vegan? You know, I mean, what I always get is, I get a question. What about your dogs? And I always say, my dogs are vegan. I have dogs that are like 8 million years old. I believe it's because they're vegan. I mean, I have dogs that are 18 years old. These dogs are vegan. And they're very healthy animals. And when they get illnesses, they come through them, I think, because they're not vegan. Right, right. However, then I get, well, what about cat? I don't know if it's cat because I have never lived with a cat. And it's not a good idea when you have a lot of dogs together because the dogs chase them around. A lot of cats don't think of that as fun. And so people will say, well, you know, and there are vegan cat foods, as I understand it. But then people will say, well, I have a cat that absolutely, you know, I put the cat, I wouldn't give the cat anything but the vegan cat food. You know, the cat went down for 4 ounces, you know, and I always ask the person, are you vegan? I would say 70% of the time they say no. I say, what the hell are you talking about the cat for? I mean, what is it about you? I mean, I wish I had been saying more. Well, what's the only issue was, you know, what are we going to do about the cat? But what I live in a world in which the animal rights movement consists largely of people who are vegetarian and not vegan, which to me is like saying, I eat meat from a small cow, but not from a big cow. It makes no sense. There is no difference between flesh and animal products and other animal products. I mean, as far as dairy is concerned, eggs are concerned, I mean, frankly, if you're just concerned about suffering, there's probably more suffering in a glass of milk and in an egg than there is in a piece of meat. The dairy animals and egg animals are kept alive longer, they're treated worse, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse anyway, and then we consume them with any matter. So, what are we worried about? I mean, you know, but there's an idea that there's some distinction we can make between flesh and between other animal products. It's crazy. And I think it's really important when we're, you know, again, you can do this in a non-confrontational way. But when an animal person says to me, I'm really sick of those animal exploiters, those people are, you know, they're evil people. I say, you a vegan? No. And I say, who's the animal exploiter? You know, these people are indifferent. They're to satisfy a demand. They exist because you exist. They exist because you're making the demand, they exist. You stop making the demand, they take their capital and they put it into something that gives them a greater return. Like prison corporations. They'll put their capital where they're coming out. Any other questions? Let's call it a night. Thanks very much.